This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we pay tribute to Elvis Presley, who died 25 years ago today. We'll hear interviews with Sam Phillips, the man who discovered Elvis, and two members of his band, drummer DJ Fontana and guitarist Scotty Moore. First, we'll hear an interview Terry recorded with Peter Guralnick, the author of what is generally acknowledged to be the definitive two-part biography of Elvis. Terry spoke with Guralnick in 1994 after the first volume, Last Train to Memphis, came out. When Elvis was 18, he went to the fledgling Sun Records in Memphis, where for $3.98 plus tax, you could make your own record. He recorded a ballad, thinking it would give him an in at Sun Records, but no one paid much attention. So he hung around the studio for several months, hoping to get Sam Phillips, the founder of the company, interested in making another recording. In 1954, Phillips finally called him in to do a session.
What he sang for Sam that day was almost entirely ballads. It would be Dean Martin's songs by Dean Martin, songs by Billy Eckstein, songs by the Ink Spots, but nothing whatsoever resembling rock and roll. And I think at the end of the day, there was a feeling of great frustration on Elvis's part. I mean, just terrible disappointment. And on Sam's part, there remained the kernel of the idea that this kid is different. He has a different sound. There may be something. What is there? You know, there's something there that can be gotten. And out of that, Sam put him together with Scotty Moore and Bill Black, and said, why don't you guys try something with him and see what happens.
Scotty Moore, the guitarist, and Bill Black, the bass player.
That's right, yeah.
So the three of them come back into the studio, and they end up, instead of doing more ballads, they end up putting out a single that on one side has Blue Moon of Kentucky, which was a Bill Monroe tune, something out of bluegrass, and on the other side had That's All Right, a kind of rhythm and blues thing by Arthur Crudup. How did they end up with that selection, considering Elvis had been pegged as a ballad singer?
I think nobody was more surprised than Sam Phillips, Scotty Moore, or Bill Black. I mean, they came to this out of sheer desperation, I think, on Elvis's part. Elvis met Scotty. He went over to Scotty Moore's house on a Sunday, Sunday, July 4th, as far as I can determine. On Monday night, they went into the studio. They really just ran through a bunch of songs. They ran through the same kinds of songs that Elvis had done for Sam Phillips in the studio previously. On Monday night, they went into the studio, and you can hear some of the early attempts, like Harbor Lights or I Love You Because, which were just pure ballads. Eventually, they were brought out years later by RCA. But it was evident by everyone's account that the session was completely falling apart. They were no more on the verge of success than Elvis had been in his initial tryout. And they took a break, and I think it was just in a moment of sheer desperation that Elvis, everybody's drinking Cokes, and all of a sudden Elvis just starts flailing away on the guitar and singing That's All Right, Mama. When Elvis started playing That's All Right, Scotty and Bill fell in and started playing along, and I'm sure it was very ragged, but Sam Phillips opened up the control room door, and he said, what are you guys doing? And they said, I don't know. And Sam said, well, whatever it is, let's back up and do it again.
Well, let's hear Elvis doing That's All Right.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. Anyway, do. Well, Mama, she done told me. Papa done told me too. Son, that guy you fooling with, she ain't no good for you. But that's all right. That's all right. That's all right.
I guess you really have to give Sam Phillips credit for hearing what it was that made Elvis Elvis and not trying to fashion him into, somebody else's mold.
I think you have to give Sam Phillips enormous credit, not only for hearing, which is unique enough in itself, but for waiting.
Right,
for not imposing himself on Elvis or on Elvis's style.
In your book, you really treat Sam Phillips with enormous respect.
Yeah, I think it's one of those remarkable accidents of history that a person of such unique talent as Elvis should be thrown in with a person of such equally unique gifts as Sam Phillips. I mean, you have really the meeting in Sam Phillips, you have someone who's as close to a genius as anyone I've ever met, and you have a person of just unswerving vision and dedication to the music. What's also interesting about the Elvis Presley story is that when Colonel Parker comes into the story, you have a person of an entirely different kind of genius, but you have someone who, in terms of entrepreneurship, in terms of marketing, in terms of, is as focused, as driven, and as single-minded as Sam Phillips was with respect to the music, and you had an enormous conflict.
When Parker brought Elvis to RCA, how did that change his sound?
It changed his sound a great deal, only because nobody at RCA knew how to record him. The Colonel had no interest in music. I don't mean to say he had no interest in music. I think he was a passionate advocate of Elvis in every way. And if Elvis had recorded in Lithuanian, the Colonel would have sought the best way to record Lithuanian spoken, you know, Lithuanian language records. But it's a mistake to see him as influencing Elvis's sound per se. What really influenced Elvis's sound was that Sam Phillips had evolved a method, and he had also worked out a way of pushing Elvis, not pushing is perhaps the wrong word, but of either inspiring Elvis or creating a climate in which Elvis could find his own voice and find his own style. At RCA, Steve Scholes was the person who essentially signed Elvis to RCA. Steve Scholes was almost a person who noted down the times. He was an A&R person. He suggested songs, but most of the songs he suggested Elvis found inappropriate. And he didn't have either a great deal creatively to contribute to Elvis, nor did he know Elvis, which was a very important point for somebody who sought reassurance. I mean, Elvis sought reassurance. He was looking for some form of approbation, and Steve Scholes didn't have it to give.
Peter, I'd like you to choose one of the RCA sessions that Elvis recorded that you think shows something about what changed for him at RCA when Sam Phillips wasn't around to help Elvis keep discovering his Elvisness.
I think a good example, and it doesn't have anything to do with the technical side, is his recording of Blue Suede Shoes. I'm sure that the reason that he recorded it was because it was such a huge hit for Carl Perkins. RCA was nervous that they had signed the wrong artist by getting Elvis rather than Carl, and probably this was Steve Scholes' idea. But the thing is, if you listen to the recording that Elvis did, which I loved at the time and continue to love, it never gets the groove. He never gets past the point. It's taken too fast. It's evident, as Elvis later said, that he simply didn't feel that he could beat Carl Perkins' version. But more than that, it just never grooves in on that inner, that you listen, for example, on the Million Dollar Quartet, and you hear him talking about Jackie Wilson's version of Don't Be Cruel, and he sings it over and over and over and over again. And I think that's how he heard a song, was just by he would hone in on it. And with Blue Suede Shoes, it stopped several steps too short.
Why don't we hear Blue Suede Shoes?
Great.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Well, do anything that you want to do, but not, honey, lay off them shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take
when
me
Elvis
over
started
my blue
producing
suede
himself
shoe
at RCA after his early sessions there, what changed for him?
What changed, I think, was that he was driving the session. It was at the July 2nd, 1956 session that produced Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel that he really took over the reins for the first time altogether. And the thing was that I think that it was at this point that he was given directions, may be the wrong word, but he was leading the musicians. He was suggesting where he wanted to go. He was suggesting voicings. He was saying, when Steve Scholl said at the end of take 18 or something that, I think we've got it now, Elvis said, no, let's keep going, and he went on for 31 takes. He allowed his own artistic vision to take precedence for the first time, and essentially, here he was at 21, he was running his own sessions.
Why don't we listen to Don't Be Cruel?
Okay.
You think this is a good record for him?
I think that for the first time he was, at RCA, he was singing in his own voice. I think that it's very different than the Sun records he made. It's much more of a pop record. But this was the direction in which he had been looking to evolve from the moment he first stepped into a studio. So that while it may not be as much to my taste as Mystery Train, say, it's a moment in which he's discovered his own Elvis voice once again.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love, baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't stop thinking of me.
Peter Guralnick speaking with Terry Gross in 1994. He's the author of Last Train to Memphis and Careless Love, The Unmaking of Elvis Presley. We'll hear more from him later on today's show. This is Fresh Air.